Get your gear ready. This is a Sherpa's Guide to Innovation. You're listening to a Sherpa's Guide to Innovation, a podcast dedicated to guiding you along your innovation expedition. I am Ben Tingey, and I host this podcast. This episode's guest is Dr. Amy Bucher, Vice President of Behavior Change Design at MadPow, a strategic design consultancy working with industry leaders to create social impact. Amy is an expert in motivational design, behavior change, health and happiness, and how technology can support them. She's previously worked at CVS Health and Johnson & Johnson, among others, received her PhD at the University of Michigan, and recently released an exceptional book published by Rosenfeld Media entitled Engaged, Designing for Behavior Change, which is the subject of our conversation today. Amy, welcome to a Sherpa's Guide to Innovation podcast.
Thanks, Ben. I'm really excited to be here, and thank you for that really kind introduction.
Awesome. We're thrilled that you would join us today. Thanks so much. A quick note to our listeners, please subscribe to and share our podcast with a colleague. You can connect with us on LinkedIn, Medium, or on Twitter at SherpaPod. Let us know what you think about this episode and give us a rating and a review. And then we would also encourage you to follow HealthPodNet on Twitter and check out the other exceptional podcasts from the Health Podcast Network, which you can find at healthpodcastnetwork.com. Additionally, we have a special promotional opportunity for listeners of this podcast. Amy, would you like to share some of the good news for our listeners?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you're interested in reading my book, Engaged, Designing for Behavior Change, and I hope you are, it is available for sale at rosenfeldmedia.com. And Rosenfeld has made a promo code available to listeners of this podcast. So it's SherpaPod0620. And that will be good for 1 month following the release of this episode. And it will get you 20% off the cover price of the book. So hopefully you're excited to read it, and I'd love to hear what you think about it. And you can use the code SherpaPod0620 to buy it from Rosenfeld Media.
Awesome. And very much encourage our listeners to do that. And we'll provide all the information in the show notes so that you can find exactly what you need to get the book and then to buy a few and share it with some others, right? All right, Amy, let's get started. We typically like to start our podcast with this question. It's a fun icebreaker. Fill in the blank. I wanted to be a blank when I grew up. Now I'm a blank and they both blank.
So you sent, I will tell the listeners, you did send me this in advance and I had to laugh because if I'm being totally honest, I wanted to be a writer when I grew up and now I'm a behavior scientist who's also a writer. So, and they both, you know, write, they both communicate. So I think in a kind of roundabout way, I ended up doing what I wanted to do. What I always loved about writing and what I continue to love about both writing and reading is the ability to put yourself into somebody else's shoes, to take on someone else's perspective and experience a different aspect of life, a situation you may not encounter, you know, really get to know somebody and understand what makes them tick through the medium of writing and reading. And so I think it's interesting that when I was a child and I said I wanted to be a writer, I probably was thinking about novels, but as an adult writing nonfiction about behavior change, I'm kind of doing the same thing just from a different lens. So it makes me feel good to think that, yeah, I did kind of grow up to be what I wanted to be.
Yeah. Dreams come true.
Yeah.
And pretty neat that the writing you get to do is good practice reps for empathy, which is so critical for designers.
Absolutely. In fact, you know, I was trained as a behavior scientist first. I really came to design and human-centered design through my professional experience. Mm. And I took to it really quickly because that empathy is so central to it. It's called to my behavior scientist nature to think about doing research and doing design in this way that really involves users and the people you're designing for and with.
Yeah. And speaking of design, could you tell us a little bit more about your company, MadPow, and the work that you do there?
Yeah. So as you mentioned in the intro here, we call ourselves a strategic design consultancy, but we really, you know, we do all the things that you would typically see a design agency do. So we can make you a beautiful website or app. But I think really what makes us special is the research, the strategy, and that human-centeredness we bring to it. So we work primarily in healthcare and financial services, and we call ourselves both good for people. We design things that are good for people and good for business. And that's really, I think, core to the way that we approach our projects. We're not looking to sell more product for the sake of selling more product. We really want to understand where in that Venn diagram of user needs and business needs there's overlap, so that we can create something that really helps people, that really helps them reach goals that they value and care about, but also advances the business interests of our clients. And I think that that means that the work we take on, it does more often have that social impact that we also talk about.
Yeah, I think that perspective is so critical and a differentiator, honestly, in these times. And so kudos to the group at MadPow. And we've worked with them before and can vouch for the creativity and the thoughtful appreciation for the social impact mission.
It's really one of the reasons why I was interested in working for MadPow. I became aware of them I've been with MadPow for about 4 years now, but I became aware of them in 2010 when they first had the very first healthcare experience design conference. And I joke that I was a little bit of a groupie after that, because there was this group, you know, in my hometown where I lived that was doing this amazing work. That was exactly the type of work I hope to be doing one day. So I would show up at any event that had a MadPow speaker and, you know, ask questions and make sure I approach the MadPow people at the networking event. It's really just the kind of organization that I admired, and it means a lot to me to be a part of it now.
Wonderful. Well, Amy, let's dig into your book. Who should read this book?
So the intended audience for this book is really the people who are working in UX and design who may not have a lot of background in behavior change. I had noticed just in, you know, navigating my way through the world and the different sorts of people that I encountered at events, at conferences, that there's a real hunger for understanding what motivates people and how you can help get them engaged from a psychological perspective among people who are in product management or visual design or UX research. And they may have some basic training in psychology, but typically, especially that motivational approach, doesn't get brought into their education and their training, but there's so much potential value there. So part of the reason I wanted to write this with Rosenfeld Media in particular is that's the audience that they target. And I really wanted to make this toolkit accessible to people in those roles.
Mm. So, and I'm joking. So you don't need a PhD to be able to do effective behavior change design?
Absolutely not. I get asked that a lot, actually. I was on a panel at UXPA International, I think 2 years ago, with a few other folks who have PhDs in psychology who are working in user experience. And we all kind of came to a consensus in the panel that basically if you are the type of nerd who wants a PhD, because it's a very deeply nerdy thing to do. Like, you spend a lot of time just doing really detailed research on, you know, some obscure topic that probably nobody else in the world cares about the way you do. If that is what gets you going, absolutely go get a PhD. But there's not a need to do it in order to do meaningful behavior change work out in the world.
Yeah. And think about how many of the jobs of today, but also the jobs of the future, are going to be in that the intersection of design and software development and interpersonal relate. I mean, that's so much of what the future is, not kind of the more maybe traditional types of roles. It really is going to matter to people to have these skills in the future.
Yeah, actually, when I look back at my own formal education, the one thing I would have done differently if I had a crystal ball and I could see where I'd end up is I probably would have taken some computer science courses, because I underestimated the extent to which digital would become a channel to do behavior change work. Hmm. You know, I started college in 1997, so it's not, you know, the internet existed and everything. I knew how to use a computer, but digital wasn't the way it is now. And looking back, that feels like a missed opportunity to have not gotten a little bit more of that programming and, you know, computer science education when I could have done it for free.
Yeah. Yeah. Certainly always opportunities for continued education, and certainly for listeners. That's, I think, yeah, as you said, the digital has such a place now in our society, and having that understanding can only just add more value.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it's a really exciting time too, is digital, you know, we're seeing so much more with sophisticated connected devices, and now they're becoming cheaper and smaller and more accessible to, you know, average people and hopefully eventually everybody. And I think that's really broadening the set of opportunities to use digital as part of how we design.
Yeah, certainly. So much of the underlying psychology for your book is the self-determination theory of motivation, which means, and I'm quoting from your book, that the most long-lasting motivation comes when people's needs for autonomy, competence, and relatedness are supported. Self-determination probably isn't the word that comes to mind when we think about how healthcare experiences have been designed over the last several decades. It's more of, I think, a supply side perspective or maybe provider centric. But there are certainly those of us that want to make a change and have it be more demand side, more consumer centric. And so for designers and innovators, how can we best advocate for that to change and for there to be a greater focus on self-determination?
Yeah, it's, you know, there isn't an easy answer to this. It's one of the central challenges of my career, certainly working both as an internal designer and with clients and, you know, advocating for patients and end users whose needs may not always align with the business interests of the entity that's hired me. But I think there's a couple of ways that we can advocate for it. And first is, there's increasingly data to show this as well, that long-term, your outcomes are going to be better if you build products and services that users want to use, that advance the goals they have for themselves, that support them in these sorts of fundamental needs, because those are the types of solutions that people stick with. And in healthcare, a lot of the outcomes that we're looking for, the really meaningful outcomes that have large dollar signs attached to them, they take a long time to produce. So if it's something like medical utilization, you want people to make less use of emergency services, for example. If you follow that back out, what you're really trying to do is change people's behavior in a consistent day-to-day way over months or years so that they are making all kinds of different choices that ultimately prevent them from having to go to an emergency room. And you know, that's a really complex web of behaviors to think about. And it also requires that people take ongoing action over that long period of time. If we build something that's just, you know, paternalistic and says, this is what you need to do, end of story, people may stick with that for a short period of time, but it's very unlikely, absent a lot of monitoring and, you know, perhaps a punishment or incentive structure in place, which is not typically scalable for an organization, they're not going to stick with that long enough for your organization to see the outcomes that you really need to see. And so I think as we see more data at this, you know, the longitudinal level that's showing that these sorts of solutions are the ones that really drive results, that's going to help a lot. So definitely telling our stories, telling our case studies. And in a more immediate sense, a tool that I found really helpful in advocating for this approach is, first of all, making sure that we are doing primary research as part of our project process. So
yes, preach.
And sometimes we really have to advocate for this because you're working with organizations who say, you know, we know our patients, we know our members, like, why do you need to talk to them again? And I mean, honestly, the reason is because people change over time. People are different from each other. They're different over time. And the context really makes a difference in how they react to something. So we want to understand people at this time in this context so that we can get the right information for this project. So it's first of all, we advocate to actually do that research. But secondly, we try to bring our client organizations into it as well. So whether it's having them observe the research, and we have ways to do, and we have in our office, literally one of those labs with the one-way glass. So we will sometimes have clients come and observe interviews if we do them physically on location there. More often, even before COVID, we would do them remotely over a tool like WebEx, and we can set it up so that our clients can observe those sessions without being obtrusive. And if that's not an option, we at least try to take video and audio clips so that we can not just share the insights that we've gotten, but share, you know, this is the emotion in this person's voice when they talk about using your healthcare. You know, this is what it does to them when you put them in this situation with this technology that is really forcing them down a particular path that doesn't align with what they want to do. And making that emotion apparent to people goes a long way toward convincing them that perhaps the design should reflect what users are looking for.
Yeah, I love your point that particularly in healthcare, we need to be in it for the long game, and that cutting corners, particularly in some of these, in the design of experiences and when they interact with us, is not going to help us with the long-term trust and loyalty that we'll need with people to manage those healthcare issues, as you said, that are much longer term in scope. And yeah, that's an excellent point. So I read chapter 7 in your book, which is entitled Harder, Better, Faster, Stronger, and I can hear the song in my head as I say that, I thought it was an exceptionally relevant chapter to what many health systems and digital health companies are trying to do with this much more prevalent role of health coaches, but then also, you know, care managers and patient navigators, who are the ones working interpersonally with consumers, trying to encourage behavior change, whether it's over text or over the phone or over some type of messaging tool on an app. What examples have you found of successful motivation techniques that really drive behavior change and maybe some unsuccessful approaches?
Yeah, so there's a class of techniques that I find myself reaching for because I've seen them work so often, which is really about understanding what a person values and then using that as a hook for the way that you talk to them about whatever the behavior is you're trying to change. So it gets back to that self-determination theory that I call on in the book. One of its core tenets as well is that the source of your motivation matters perhaps just as much as the amount of your motivation. And the long-lasting forms of motivation come from things that you deeply and personally value. They tend to be very specific to you, very individual. You know, we need to realize what those things are if we're going to try to use them to motivate people. So technology will allow us sometimes to actually find that out, or something like a care navigator, a care manager, a live person. They can, of course, ask this in a conversation. And if we know that specifically, we can actually just talk about it or reflect it back through the technology experience. Sometimes, though, we don't know, and we can use things like rhetorical questions to get people to reflect on it themselves and then draw some of those connections on their own. It's a little bit less direct, but it seems like it does get people thinking about personal reasons for wanting to engage in a particular course of behavior.
And in your book, you mentioned, and sorry to interject, but you mentioned sort of the more affirming responses, kind of the Carl Rogers approach that maybe a lot of chatbots are using right now, that is that almost kind of restates what the person says, but in the form of a question, and then it just gets them talking more and more and more.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually, one program that I like a lot that I think does this really well, I will caveat, actually, I haven't used more than the free trial of it, but Noom. During onboarding, they do a really nice job of drilling down on people's goals for the program. So they ask you why you're, and I included, I think, a screenshot from it in the book as an example, but they ask you why you're there. And then they ask you, okay, but really why, like, what is that goal helping you to do? And it's similar to product management. You know, you have the five whys or the ladder of whys, and you just keep drilling down until the person gets frustrated and says, just because, like, that's the smallest possible answer. But similarly with goals, you know, people don't always have a lot of practice with thinking about what really matters to them and articulating it in this neat little package. And so going through an exercise like Noom does, where you know, ask somebody what they want to do, and then you keep getting them to clarify it to increasing levels of detail, that can be a really helpful thing to do. And my understanding is that Noom doesn't really do a lot with that data beyond, I think, display it back to the user occasionally. I'm not sure if they analyze it or actually do anything deeper with it in terms of personalizing the program, but just having the person go through that exercise and having that information for themselves can really help them to have a strong source of motivation that will propel them through the program.
Yeah, Noom's a great example of that. And any that you've come across that maybe aren't such great examples?
Yeah, I mean, I'm always wary of incentive structures, and they're really common, especially in the business-to-business healthcare model, where, and a lot of my career was building coaching programs that we sold to either health insurance plans or self-insured employers, and they would then make them available to their members or their employees. So it's the sort of thing, if your health plan offers you a wellness platform, they're probably paying another company to make that available to all of their members for free. And many times our clients would want to put an incentive structure in place so that they could get more people using these programs. And that, you know, there are definitely ways that you can use incentives that are more effective. Kevin Volpe from University of Pennsylvania has done a lot of work on different ways to structure incentives programs so that you actually get at the behaviors you want to. But in general, most people aren't going at it with that level of detail and nuance. They're just doing something like, let's pay people one time for participating in this program. And what that tends to do is it fixates people on the reward rather than the process. And so you really get them just performing the behaviors they need to do to get the reward instead of probably the more deeper and meaningful behaviors. Thinking about the digital programs that I worked on, people would often get their incentives for completing them, for hitting submit on a questionnaire. Well, I mean, that's great. Like the data has some value to the business customer, but the real value is if people take the output of that questionnaire and they make changes in their real life based on it. And that's not what they were getting rewarded for. So they don't really have a motivation within that structure to do the things that really matter. So that's what, and I mean, the other thing too, just thinking from a business perspective, an incentive scheme isn't necessarily sustainable over time. People, once you put incentives in place, they expect them to continue to be there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they probably actually expect them to grow over time, right? Just, you know, rate of inflation. So if you're an organization that really wants to have people participate in a program and your instinct is to pay them for it, understand that you're going to have to pay them to do it every single time it needs to happen. And you may need to increase the rate that you're paying. So that right away sort of opens this can of worms from a business perspective that I think there are ways to avoid if you think a little bit differently about motivation.
Yeah. And if I remember correctly, the work that you did with those employers in a lot of ways was what triggered your journey. I think that was something you mentioned at the beginning of the book was maybe this frustration about working so hard to put these programs together, but not seeing the behavior change on the other side.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I opened talking about the Illinois Workplace Wellness Study, you know, which basically a lot of research has found that in general, workplace wellness programs don't work. And I think that that's absolutely accurate for the way that those programs end up being implemented and the incentive structures put around them. But my frustration is having worked on those sorts of programs, there's typically a lot of really good stuff in there. And it, with some attention to the implementation, and perhaps, you know, I always also think about offering a menu of programs to people, because unless you have very sophisticated personalization, any one program is not likely to work for everybody. So why not have a handful of things that you can offer to people, you know, carefully vetted options, but that meet different needs, different styles, so that among your entire population, everybody can find something they like. And that very rarely happens. So I have a lot of frustration with that and sort of the conclusion that these programs are not good. I think really it's some of these programs are good and we need to think about how to use them in a way that allows them to produce the outcomes they're capable of.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about how you can make those improvements. So I mean, many of our listeners are likely familiar with tools like customer journey maps and personas, and those are often used when designing services or experiences. And it seems that those could be enhanced by layering on some of the behavior change design principles, which you outline in the book. What recommendations would you have for designers to incorporate more of those behavior change design principles into that work? So say if they were working on improving a workplace wellness program or something, how could they layer in more of that behavior change design to make it stick?
Yeah, so we actually do a lot of this at MadPow, which I really like because for me, it's an opportunity to take the behavior change toolkit and layer it into these sorts of design tools and methodologies, where for my colleagues who come from more of a design background, it's a chance to do the opposite with the behavior change piece. So yeah, I feel like we both get to stretch our skill sets a bit when we collaborate like this. But one thing we've done quite a bit recently, and I feel really excited about, is create journey maps that build the COMB model of behavior change into them. So I talk about COMB in the book, and I talk about it in terms of barriers, and I think I call them, what do I call them? Ability boosters and
blockers.
And, yeah. Yes. Uh-huh. So, but basically COMB is this model. It's an acronym. The B is behavior and COM is capability, opportunity, motivation. So the central idea, very simple, for a person to do a behavior, they have to have the capability and the opportunity and the motivation to do it. And there's, of course, quite a bit of detail underneath each of those. But what we essentially do, and we're starting our research that we would do anyway to build a journey map, we add questions into our materials that specifically look at capability, opportunity, motivation. And part of the exercise as well is being very specific right at the outset about the behaviors that we're looking at. So what are we looking for people to be doing along this journey? When we do our research, we're trying to identify, what barriers exist in each of those three categories. And then another part of the model is actually, it's almost like a decision tree. They've done this, really robust literature review of published studies, and they found that consistently, if you have a physical capability issue, for example, this is the type of solution set that is likely to work there. So it's a way to follow a decision tree and say, based on what we've identified in our research, these are the solution areas that we should start with when we get into the more design part of the process. And so what we've been able to do is we actually indicate on our journey maps now, like, here are some of the barriers. We can code them for whether they're capability, opportunity, or motivation. And then we can specify that if you customer are using this journey map to make design decisions for your roadmap or, for some specific initiative, here's what we think is going on here that's stopping people from being on the ideal journey. And now here are some suggestions about where to start your design process so that you can successfully address that and get them onto the ideal journey path.
I have to be honest, that was one of my favorite parts of the book. Especially the grid that you make that has the COMB on the, the sort of the questions you ask about capability and motivation
opportunity.
Opportunity on the kind of the y-axis, and then x-axis you have, you kind of lay out, what would be, what are we hearing in our primary research? What could be a potential intervention? Like, I love that layer because it makes it so actionable. So one of the tools that we use and our team and our listeners will be familiar with is the jobs to be done theory. We use that all the time, particularly the four forces of progress: pushes, pulls, habits, and anxieties. But it seems to me that while there are some similarities, I think there are some key differentiators in the COMB approach. What additional value do you believe the COMB model and the grid that you use brings over other tools, maybe like jobs to be done?
Yeah. And I'm not sure if it's fair to pit them against each other necessarily. I think that, different situations call for different tools. So I would think of it more like a hammer and a screwdriver. They are each the right tool for the, different jobs. It's kind of funny to say about jobs to be done, but a big difference, I think, between them is that the COMB model comes from the behavior change literature. So the group that developed it is out of University College of London, and they open source most of their materials. So if people are interested in learning more, if you Google behavior change wheel, behavior has the U because they're British, you can find a lot of their materials and some training courses and things online that are really helpful learning more of this. But it all came from the behavior change literature. And so if we are doing a project that is really specifically focused on changing the behavior of people in the ecosystem, it's very helpful to start from a theory or a framework that takes that into account. And similarly, with the intervention sets that get suggested as part of the framework, they all have this behavior change flavor to them. To me, a lot of the value is being able to go back to that published evidence base and look for other solutions that have been out there in the past that we can either, leverage, maybe do a design iteration on them, or, take some of the features of it that we think might work really nicely for our space. Or sometimes it's learning in the negative as well, right? Like they designed this thing and it didn't work, or it did work, but it's not going to work for our customer for XYZ reason. But it at least gives us this anchor that we can go back to that, again, is really connected to behavior change. So that to me is a really big part of the value. And the other thing I like about it a lot, actually, is it gives us a lot of grist for designing the research. I talk about this in the book too. I often use it both for designing interview moderator guides and then observation guides if we have the opportunity to tour.
Oh, interesting. Location. Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, that's really helpful because, as I'm sure you know, when you interview people, they don't always tell you everything that you need to know, whether it's because they haven't, spent the time to generate that insight. Sometimes it's social desirability, especially in health. Like, people have a sense of what they should be doing, and if their real behavior isn't like that, sometimes they'll fudge a bit and they'll talk themselves up more than maybe reality.
Sure, sure.
So it's really helpful a lot of times to be able to go and do that observation and kind of compare what you've observed versus what the person has told you, and where are they aligned, and where might there be some discrepancy where now it's time for us to do a little bit of interpretation about what might be going on there. But I do think that ComB lends itself really nicely to designing those research materials more so than jobs to be done, with, again, the caveat that I'm not a jobs to be done expert the way I am a ComB expert. So I may be missing something there.
No, I think that's fair. And as I'm riffing a little bit here, but as I think about the two models, when I think about capability, opportunity, motivation, to me, that feels like a really good description of the person's context. And I think you can pair that well with jobs to be done, because it's all about the progress that an individual is seeking in a given context. And so I think jobs interviewing helps you understand their desired progress, but it doesn't necessarily help you change or improve the person's context so that they're more maybe amenable or capable of change. And yeah, I'm riffing here, but
that makes sense. And I always think of jobs to be done as a way to really understand a person's goal state. You know, what are they trying to achieve here? Which I think is maybe different from what ComB is doing, because in that case, when you define the behavior, you're sort of saying what the goal state is. So I could actually see the two working nicely together. But it's also funny you mentioned context, because we recently for a client did an illustration of ComB. They were doing some training materials for their staff. They wanted to teach them how to use the model. And we ended up basically doing a little stick figure guy with a big heart who's standing in a circle. And we, very simplified, but the person themselves is the capability, right? That's their ability to do something. The heart was the motivation. And then that circle was the opportunity, because that is very much about the environment, the context. What does it permit you to do or prohibit you from doing? So just funny you mentioned that, because I do think of that as being a really key part of ComB.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I kept thinking about looking at the grid that you made, is, wow, I wonder if there's some funky hybrid we could make with some of the jobs tools that we use and that, because I think that layering would be really interesting.
Yeah.
Another question that I have is, with some exceptions, maybe most notably Providence St. Joseph, most health systems aren't building their own digital health solutions. Most don't have a huge team of programmers and coders and stuff. But more often health systems are purchasing these tools. And our job is more about, and this is something Dr. Zev Neuwirth, who has been on our podcast and has his own amazing podcast, has talked to us recently about, is that our job is a little more about curating and integrating the multitude of digital solutions across a consumer's care experience and also within our own tech platforms. And so we have to think about how all these tools fit together and what the experience is like for consumers engaging maybe with more than one type of digital experience. So thinking about it from kind of a macro level, so what maybe guidelines or principles should health systems follow when they're thinking about this sort of higher level curation and integration work and the behavior change design that they're trying to elicit from that kind of amalgamation of tools?
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm actually seeing this with the project I'm working on right now, which is with a health plan, a little different from a health system, but, you know, similar. I think they've amalgamated a large number of really great tools, and the member experience is not cohesive the way they would like it to be. Mm-hmm. You know, I think a tool like a journey map can be really helpful here if you build it for multiple types of members, consumers, patients, whatever you want to call them, because we also have to understand that not everybody is following the happy path. So you will have people who have chronic conditions that need ongoing management, people with acute conditions, you know, people with a mix of the two. Behavioral health is its own beast. So I do think there has to be some upfront work in understanding what the patient journey looks like for whatever the big buckets of experiences might look like for your organization. But then thinking about, you know, how do you make sure that people are aware of the tools available to them? Awareness is just such a huge, it's a huge challenge. And I'm seeing that, you know, again, with my client where they're wondering about why some of these excellent tools that they have are underutilized. And as we do our research, it's because people just don't know they exist. They don't even know to look for them because they don't have a sense that they might exist. So there's a lot of work that can be done to communicate to people that this suite of tools exists for you, that these are benefits that you can take advantage of, and here's how they will help you. And you know, the answer to how that happens will vary depending on your environment and your customer. But I think that right there is a big thing. And then there's also the cohesion bit too, right? How do I make sure that these all feel like part of an experience? We did some work a few years ago with a government agency that offers apps. And part of what we did there was help them to create a design language so that I think before, and I will again caveat, I wasn't personally part of this project, so I may be getting the backstory just a little bit wrong, but it seemed like they had amassed a whole bunch of really good apps. They'd basically gone out and done a big evaluation and said, like, here are 50 amazing apps that can help our members. And they threw them all on a web page, and people weren't using them because they weren't really organized or sorted, and there wasn't any real clear relationship to their organization. Like, why would I go here to get this app that I could just go to the app store to get? And so part of what we helped them think through was, you know, how do you tell a story to your members about why all of these apps are part of your ecosystem? And how can we actually put a design layer on them so that they look like they're part of a family? That sort of thing gives people reassurance that this is a, you know, this is a credible, legitimate resource that I'm using as a benefit for this organization that I belong to. Yeah, and I think a third thing that I do see a lot in the healthcare environment is making sure that whatever different apps people are using, that there's some kind of communication loop back to their overall care. Because sometimes these things really feel like they're satellites off in the ether, and people don't get a sense that it's helpful to them, that it's impacting the way that they're interacting with the health system. So to the extent that it can be, there can be some kind of communication, like, you know, this patient has downloaded this app and they're using it, just so that the care manager or the provider can follow up later on and say, oh, hey, I saw you downloaded this. How is it going? Or even, you know, your biometrics are looking different. Is it because you used this app? I think that that closure of the loop could go a long way, because right now, one of the things that we're seeing is that people feel like, you know, when they do see an app being offered by a health system or a provider, it just feels like it's kind of floating out there with no real impact.
Yeah, that's a good takeaway. So a couple more questions, Amy, and then we'll wrap it up. Thinking about behavior change in the COVID-19 era, how might maybe more public spaces in the health and wellness arena, like gyms and primary care practices and urgent care centers, et cetera, how might they employ some behavior change design to address what we're seeing come from a lot of consumer surveys about safety concerns? You know, I don't want to go back unless I have an assurance that it's safe. How might those physical places think about designing for that behavior change, having people return?
Yeah. I've done some thinking about this with respect to workplaces in general, but I think it's even more critical for places where health happens because, you know, just by necessity, you may be physically close to a provider, for example, or in a gym, you're using equipment that somebody else may have just used or they're using very nearby you. So I think it becomes all the more critical for those spaces. I've used the Calm B model a bit to think about this, and I think it has some helpful lessons for us. So one that I think is very sort of obvious once you think of it, but maybe not obvious before you do, around capability. A key part of capability is having access to the materials, the equipment you need to stay safe. And so that may mean making disposable masks and gloves available, as well as places to throw them away. That's a thing that I see a lot of people forgetting. And so you may see a place that's trying really hard to maintain safety inside, but then you leave and there's just a pile of, you know, trash that now feels much more like dirty trash to us because we're associating it with the potential viral contagion. So making those sorts of things available can go a long way. I think another big thing to think about, though, is making your efforts extremely visible to people, because we are programmed to look for evidence of our actions in the world. And I think a thing that's been really, really hard about COVID for people and some of the behaviors that we've been urged to adopt, like social distancing, is they operate against the way that our brains are wired in terms of that evidence. So we're really used to looking for, I do something and then something happens as a result. And right now we're often being asked to do nothing. And if we're lucky, the result is nothing happens because nobody else gets sick. So it's just the opposite of the way that our brains are wired to work. And you can see, especially now that this has been going on for a few months, people are getting really fatigued, in part because they're not sure if what they're doing is helping. It's really, really hard for people. And so I think the more that you can make some of these changes visible, the more that you can make it feel like it's kind of a social effort. Everybody here is taking part in this. That's going to help people feel good about taking part in it too.
Outstanding points and very relevant, creating that unification around a cause and that united purpose. That's great. So last question, I wish we could talk for a couple more hours. Last question, this will be maybe more broad. What organizations, and they could be inside or outside of healthcare, really anywhere, which organizations are shining examples of effective behavior change design? And what can corporate innovators and entrepreneurs like most of our listeners do and to learn from them?
Yeah, there are two that I thought of. One who I think would probably call themselves behavior change and one that certainly wouldn't. So one is Starbucks. And I think that the way that they have set up their app and their reward system is really brilliant for engagement. So I talked a little bit before about some of the issues with incentives. Starbucks is a shining example of a company that uses an incentive scheme that encourages exactly the behavior they want. So you use the mobile app, you earn stars for your purchases. Those stars add up to free coffee or pastries. They just keep you coming back to Starbucks, which is exactly what they want you to do. And I think that that kind of focus on the behavior of buying a Starbucks product, both at the, you know, what are we rewarding and then what are the rewards enabling? You know, it's brilliant. It's brilliant. And that app has been enormously successful. For a while, they actually had to throttle it because so many people were using it that the stores couldn't physically keep up fulfilling the orders.
Oh, wow.
So, I mean, that's, you can't get better than that. So that's one. And then the other one that I think is really amazing in terms of the way that it structures the behaviors it asks people to do is Duolingo, which is the free language learning platform. And I do think they would probably call themselves behavior change because they're trying to get people to take these lessons and ultimately master a new language. But they do this really nice job of taking what is a pretty complex thing, right? Like learning a new language has a lot of moving parts, and especially if it's one that doesn't resemble your native language or is really completely new to you. And they've done a lot of work to break that process down into really small, achievable pieces that they then stagger so that, you know, you do lesson one and it feels achievable with no background. And then when you do lesson two, you've learned just enough in lesson one that now this too is achievable. And so that sort of goal scaffolding, that's a really important behavior change design skill that you don't see done well a lot of times. But Duolingo has really, really done a great job of it. And I think it's one of the reasons why they're so popular. And they actually, they've taken this down, but I used to link to this paper that they did. They had hired some researchers and they found that a person who completed an entire Duolingo course had the same language achievement as someone who took a full two semesters in a university, which is amazing.
Wow.
So I'm not sure why they took it down. I don't know if something happened with those results or if they're planning on publishing it somewhere, but they used to have this white paper up and I was just like, wow, that's really effective actually, that something you do online with no actual, you're not talking to a person, right? You're not getting the language learning that way, but you're still getting to that same level of achievement. That's pretty good.
Yeah, that's remarkable. And it goes back to the foundational self-determination theory, which is people's desire for competency and mm-hmm. wanting to increase their competency.
Yeah. And I will say too, the type of feedback Duolingo gives, they don't just say yes or no, but they also give you information that helps you learn and do better next time, which is a real skill in giving feedback.
Perfect. Well, Amy, thank you so much. What a thought-provoking conversation about designing for behavior change. This was a real gift. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Ben. I really enjoyed talking to you. I really appreciate it.
Great. And listeners, I trust this conversation has convinced you to purchase Amy's book. And so as a reminder, you can use the promo code SherpaPod0620 to get 20% off. We'll have the information in the show notes, but buy it for yourself and then buy it for a friend or a colleague who does design work, behavior change work. Really, I mean, it's an awesome book anyways. So we'll, as I mentioned, we'll provide the links and thanks to Amy and Rosenfeld Media for the discount. Appreciate it. Awesome. Well, this is Ben Tingey. Thanks so much for listening. We'll catch you next time. Like me to address you, Dr. Bucher or Amy or
call me Amy.
Okay.
I would like you to, address me as doctor from now on. There's really no reason why. I just think it'd be neat.